Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers. Additional KCRW programs and podcasts are available at kcrw.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
What went wrong with Katrina? What's next? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff got a grilling today from senators of both parties. Why did disaster workers run around like Keystone Cops in response to Hurricane Katrina? At the same time, a committee of House Republicans called the federal response a national disgrace. On To the Point, there's a lot of tough talk on Capitol Hill, but will multiple investigations find out what really went wrong? Will they produce new strategies for future disasters? Will they be any help to Katrina victims, many of whom are still without housing or jobs? On Reporter's Notebook later on, Vice President Cheney and political damage control. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. Even the Bush White House is said to be preparing its own scathing report on the federal response to Katrina. So are committees in both houses on Capitol Hill. On To the Point, will they find out what really went wrong? Will they produce new strategies for future disasters? What about Katrina victims who still don't have housing or jobs? On Reporter's Notebook, Vice President Cheney is scheduled to break his public silence on this weekend's hunting accident. We'll hear about politics inside the Bush White House. First, this news update. This has not been an easy day for Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff. A Senate committee hearing began with tough questions about the response to Katrina, like this one from Connecticut Democrat Joseph Lieberman.
How could you have left us with so many of those agencies so unprepared that when Katrina struck, too many of them ran around like Keystone Cops, uncertain about what they were supposed to do or unable to do it?
Mr. Chertoff began his response by describing the magnitude of the challenge posed by the hurricane.
You can't escape the fact when you talk about Katrina that this was a storm of unprecedented magnitude. Not because it was a surprise, because I don't think it was a surprise that a storm like this could happen, but because in terms of prior experience, at least as far as I know, nobody in living memory recalls a set of challenges as difficult as those presented by this hurricane.
Michael Chertoff at the outset of today's hearing. Bobby Block covered it all for the Wall Street Journal, and Bobby Block, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
How'd it go for the secretary?
You know, he's been in the crosshairs of so many people as of late, and he has a very thin skin. He doesn't like criticism. I think the last time we may have talked, the General Accountability Office, which is the investigative arm of Congress, came out and blamed a lot of what went wrong specifically on the secretary and on DHS, and they were immediately ringing off the phone. The phones were ringing off the hook at the GAO with complaints from DHS. But having said that, he was very calm, he was very composed, and I think that while there were some people who would like to take his head home on a stick, I think that he's precluded that. He came across as very sincere, very apologetic, and while he didn't provide completely satisfactory answers and there were some contradictions, he seemed to come across as someone who wanted to get things right.
You say he was apologetic. What exactly did he take responsibility for from a personal standpoint?
Well, I mean, he said that insofar that he was in charge of the entire response that and that DHS was the event that was the agency that was supposed to be in charge of the whole thing, that it was he bears responsibility for the good and the bad. This is a line that he's been repeated. He was much less combative than he was 2 days ago when he spoke to a bunch of emergency managers, where he accused critics of trying to drive a wedge, between the agency and its all its components by assuming that they were focused on terror but not natural disasters. But as much as he says that, It still remains unclear of why they were so flat-footed, how they could have let things get so out of control, and it does seem that they were rather disengaged in the early days of when the storm was approaching.
Still unclear after all of this. In addition to the Senate hearing today, of course, there was a Republican report in the House released as well.
Yes, and this report was blaming everybody, all layers of government. But it's clear that DHS and FEMA came in for the lion's share of the blame. I mean, ironically, the report that came out from the House also takes to task the DOD and the Coast Guard, which everyone assumed to have been, you know, emerged from this wart free, and says they could have done a better job coordinating, that the coordination was bad. Certainly the Coast Guard comes out much better than the Department of Defense, but the Department of Defense is also accused of dragging its feet. Katrina was a national failure, it said, an abdication of the most solemn obligation to provide for the common welfare. At every level, there was failure. I mean, this is pretty damning stuff. I think the thing that's most important in all of this, what I find most worrying, is that the emergency directors from all the states were holding a winter's meeting here, and that was the event at which the secretary spoke the other day. And these guys, while applauding and saying nice things to public, behind the scenes are latching on to people like me and going, we're petrified. Hurricane season is 5 months away, and FEMA and the department are worse than before. And we are in a position that we have to start making plans where we cannot count on the federal government.
Did the senators today raise that kind of issue with Michael Chertoff?
Chertoff raised it himself. I mean, Chertoff was basically, I mean, one of the things that I believe Chertoff, I mean, not only did this NEMA conference, that's the National Association of Emergency Managers, provide a great forum for him to announce this kind of what he's calling the retooling of FEMA, which when you look at it very carefully, there's not a lot there about what it's broad brush, but he doesn't tell you how he's going to get there. But, you know, he's maintaining, it was defensive. It's like a best defense, a good offense. He's coming out. We're going to shake everything up. And he's saying that, of course, he recognizes that the pressure is on, that he has to do this because hurricane season is just a few months away.
Okay. Bobby Block, Homeland Security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. We'll continue this conversation with him and others in just a moment as the effort goes on to try to figure out what happened with Hurricane Katrina. And we will ask if these efforts to find out what went wrong are going to lead to making things better. A little later, we'll be talking about Vice President Cheney and damage control with regard to the Huntington accident over this weekend. Back in a moment with To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, again talking about the effort to find out what went wrong with Katrina. Very much on the agenda today on Capitol Hill with a hearing in the Senate and a release by a committee of Republicans. Bobby Block is still with us, Homeland Security correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. This, a lot of this Republican report was leaked in advance. The official announcement and complete release occurred today. Anything new or surprising?
No, it's incredibly detailed. I mean, it's 600 pages long. I'm just like 80 pages into it now. It's only officially released at 2. It talks about a lot of the things that we know about how things failed, how planning exercises like this famous Hurricane Pam, which took place a year before Katrina, which was a fictional kind of tabletop exercise where federal and state and local guys got together and said, you have a bad hurricane, what are you going to do? And there was never any follow-up to it, which was because Homeland Security took money away from FEMA. A lot of what Michael Brown says is true, although Mike made a lot of mistakes on his own, but that was that he had been fighting for a long time for a brighter day in the sun for FEMA inside of Homeland Security. He didn't get it under Secretary Ridge, and he certainly didn't seem to get it under Secretary Gary Chernoff either.
Okay, Bobby Block again with the Wall Street Journal. We'll come back to him from time to time as we go on with our program. First, I want to introduce Benny Thompson. He is a Democratic congressman from Mississippi. He's also a ranking member on the House Committee on Homeland Security. And, Congressman, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
You and other Democrats, excepting for two, did not agree to participate in this in the report just mentioned by Bobby Block. Pretty extensive. Why didn't you take part?
Well, a lot of us felt that you really needed a 9/11 type commission, independent of the politics, to look at what went wrong with Katrina. As long as you had an entity that was political in nature and in so many instances partisan, you really couldn't get to the bottom of what went wrong, nor could you deal with how to fix it. And unfortunately, the report put a lot of information as to what went wrong, but we don't have any recommendations as to how to fix it.
As far as what went wrong is concerned, do you think that the report is exhaustive enough at 600 pages?
Well, obviously, it's quite exhaustive, but there are still, and I'm going through it at this point myself.
Okay.
There are some aspects of it that I think was omitted, and it's the communication between FEMA, DHS, and the White House. The subpoena power was not invoked with this commission, so we did not have access to those records. So there's still a cloud over exactly what was the communication link, and when did people know, and how fast did they respond? So while the report talks about the leadership failings at the federal, state, and local level, it talks about some of the other shortcomings. We still, at this point, can't fix it based on this report.
Let me go back to Bobby Block. Was there at the Senate committee hearing today any light shed on, for example, the relationships between FEMA and the Department of Homeland Security and the White House?
Not so much with the White House. I mean, insofar as in Brown's testimony last week, he said, and this was the extension of the battle that I was talking before, Brown said that he purposefully chose to ignore Chertoff and go directly to the White House because he felt that Chertoff and DHS was an unnecessary level of bureaucracy and that FEMA traditionally has always had a direct report to the White House. And, of course, this problem of going outside the command is what Secretary Chertoff and DHS points to as the main reason for the failure, is that everyone did not have the same common operating picture.
Back to Congressman Thompson, do you think that FEMA ought to be taken out of the Department of Homeland Security and made directly responsible then to the White House?
Well, I do, but the circumstances will absolutely prevent that. This White House will not admit that by putting FEMA in the Department of Homeland Security, they made a mistake. The only thing we can do is to give FEMA back some of its core missions, which have actually been taken away from it since it went into the Department of Homeland Security. We can streamline the communication between the FEMA director and the White House, and it should be. But more importantly, we need to have a qualified person running FEMA. It should not be a person who's a political supporter of the president or this administration without portfolio. And what we've had in the past with Michael Brown and to some degree the director before him, a skill set that was woefully inadequate for a FEMA director.
Meantime, what's happening in your state of Mississippi right now? We hear a lot about New Orleans and about Louisiana, but how bad is the situation now in Mississippi?
Well, we're continuing to struggle. We did not get as much of, well, we didn't get any of the flood water like New Orleans from the levees. However, we did get the surge from the Gulf. We're grappling with absolute devastation. We're trying to resolve the issue of getting temporary housing for people, what we see with so many trailers in Arkansas that could be in Mississippi and Louisiana is unfortunate. We're trying to make sure that we can get the schools up and going and a number of transitional circumstances. We're working it out. Obviously, our devastation, while great, pales in comparison to what the people of New Orleans and that part of Louisiana had to contend with.
Well, thanks, as always, for being on our program.
Thank you very much.
Benny Thompson, Democratic congressman from Mississippi, ranking member on the House's Committee on Homeland Security. Also with us today, Mark Smith. He's the public information officer for the Louisiana Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness. Speaks to us from Baton Rouge. Mr. Smith, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And let me ask you the same question I just asked Benny Smith with a little more specificity. This is the day, as I understand it, or yesterday was, when the hotel hotels ran out for a lot of people in New Orleans in particular. What's happening now?
Well, right now, many of the people have found alternate housing options. For those who haven't found housing options, the state of Louisiana has opened an emergency shelter and has offered to provide our residents transportation from the hotel where they were living to the shelter. Right now, we've only had to reopen one shelter, but with the looming March 1st deadline, we fear that that may rise even further.
So on March 1st, then, even more people will be no longer able to stay in hotels at government expense?
Yes.
There are a lot of people I've heard on the radio and read about in the papers who say that they're really angry at this idea, that they shouldn't have to go to emergency shelters this long after the disaster. And they're angry, and among other things, because there haven't been trailers moved into some of the neighborhoods that were devastated by the flooding. How do you respond to those kinds of concerns?
The response to those concerns is, yes, getting the trailers in has been slow in some areas, and there's been a multitude of reasons for that. I think you'd be better served asking FEMA for the specific reasons. But we had no intention or no desire to put people back into shelters. But with the cancellation of the hotel program and the knowledge that some of those residents would not have another place to go, we were left with no other option but to reopen a shelter.
Is it, do you think, going to be the case, despite the opening of the shelters, that there will be some people who end up homeless and on the streets?
Yes.
Why?
Because the shelter that we have open is in Shreveport, Louisiana. And, for instance, we know that certain people have sent their families to Shreveport to be in the shelter, but the primary worker in the family has stayed behind to continue to try to earn a living in the stricken area.
So those folks are just out of luck if they can't stay in the hotels anymore?
No, we do offer the sheltering. Again, it's
but not... They can't go to Shreveport for shelter and work in New Orleans at the same time?
No, they cannot.
So they're going to end up on the street?
We have caseworkers working with through the Department of Social Services that will work with those people to find them shelter if at all possible. There are some options available here in Baton Rouge through faith-based organizations and some options available in New Orleans through homeless coalitions.
Again, Mark Smith is Public Information Officer for the Louisiana Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness. Back to Bobby Block, still with us, Homeland Security Correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Did the Senate committee today take up what would appear, from what we're hearing from Mark Smith, to be a very urgent situation in New Orleans?
Absolutely, and it was one of the constant refrains. As a matter of fact, at the very beginning, after Secretary Chertoff read his statement, a man from sitting in the gallery stood up and started to complain precisely about how it was possible that in the United States, after such a tragedy, people could be thrown out onto the streets. I mean, like so many of these issues, you know, the questions of why are things still not working at FEMA? Mike Brown is no longer there and can't be blamed. And, you know, all you have is we're trying to make it work. Like so much of the investigation, I think this is the 20th hearing that the Senate has. And what you have found after 500,000 pages of emails and documents, the more information you find, the more questions you have. There's just so much in here that makes one wonder how could this have gone so badly. And it just seems that everybody messed up from top to bottom.
Back to Mark Smith in Louisiana. Bobby Block reported earlier that off camera, as it were, some of the state emergency directors have told him and other reporters that they're really petrified as the next hurricane season approaches. Are you petrified?
With the condition of the levee system and the infrastructure in southeast Louisiana and southwest Louisiana, it's a really, really scary time for us. So much relies on the Corps of Engineers getting the levees back up to standard in New Orleans, and us finding adequate housing for our residents who've already been displaced. The idea of another hurricane coming into our area is truly frightening.
Of course, Bobby Block, back to you. There's been no shortage of blame placed on local and state officials in Mississippi and in particular in Louisiana. Was that also part of what came up today?
Yeah, I mean, there's a recognition that there were problems in the state. But, I mean, I think that as people are looking at this more and more, and as there is some dispassion growing, look, the very fact that we have a national emergency response system is a recognition of the fact that there are going to be events that are too big for states to handle. And so, yes, I mean, people recognize that mistakes were done, and you could sometimes be forgiven for listening to these hearings and thinking that New Orleans, no one evacuated from New Orleans, when in fact 85 or 84% of the people did evacuate. The problem ultimately, what broke down at the end of the day was the federal system to be able to catch the state when it fell. And that's the thing that everybody is hoping will get fixed. And part of the problem, like I was saying before, the more they find out that's gone wrong, the more they're sort of like deer in headlights, not unsure of how to proceed to fix this thing. And they're starting to reach out. The Senate committee, I know, is starting to reach out to people and asking technical experts to try to help them give a roadmap for the way forward, because at the end of this process, legislation is supposed to be coming that's supposed to help recreate FEMA either outside the Department of Homeland Security, which I do not think is likely, or give it some better structure inside the department.
Mark Smith, quickly, you have this scary situation with the hurricanes approaching. What's the one thing that the federal government could do now that would help Louisiana the most?
Get the levees fixed and up to standards and implement some sort of control on an interoperable communications network.
And quickly, Bobby Block, is that going to happen?
Hopefully, but at this stage, it's just unclear.
Okay, we're going to continue this conversation about the situation at the Department of Homeland Security. Thanks very much to Bobby Block with the Wall Street Journal and also Mark Smith with the Louisiana Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness. Thanks also to Benny Thompson, the congressman from Mississippi. We'll be back in a moment to once again continue this conversation, talk for more about the future. Should FEMA stay within the Department of Homeland Security? Should it be placed elsewhere? Are the investigations doing all they can? We heard earlier that subpoenas were not issued. On Reporter's Notebook later, Vice President Cheney is scheduled an interview about this weekend's hunting accident. We'll hear about internal politics at the Bush White House. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Well, I'm only back with To the Point. Once again, talking about Hurricane Katrina, the structure of emergency response in the United States. We've heard about the Senate hearing that is going on today with Senators Lieberman and Collins, the Republican from Maine, at the helm. House Republican, largely Republican report released today, 600 pages long, scathing criticism of FEMA, the Department of Homeland Security, with swipes at local and state officials as well. There's a White House investigation coming up. It, too, is said to be scathing, according to those who have gotten advanced reports. And there's been a report by the General Accountability Office of the Congress. Bev Sigler is professor of public policy and administration at Penn State University in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Ms. Sigler, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Do you think that these investigations are getting to the bottom of what happened?
Well, I think there are some problems so far. Let's just talk about the House report, because that's the one that everybody's looking at this week. I think that the subpoena power and or lack of use of it that was mentioned earlier is really a big problem. And what they're coming out with is basically a laundry list of what went wrong, whereas what you really need to know is who, what, when, where, why, and how, so that you can really get at fixing things. And what they basically say is, I think, too generalized. When everybody's in charge, no one's in charge. When everybody's to blame, no one's to blame. And I think the data so far, the evidence so far from all the hearings and the documentation does show that it was the lack of the use of the National Response Plan by the federal government that was the key problem, and perhaps also the current culture in DHS. And that does not come out in these reports so far.
DHS, of course, the Department of Homeland Security. When you say, as Congressman Thompson did earlier on our program, that the subpoena power was not used, who should the subpoena power have been used to require to come and testify?
Well, I think that much more needs to be done in terms of getting documentation from both the White House and from the Department of Defense.
And let's focus on those two. First, starting with the Department of Defense, what did it have to do with this fiasco, and how would subpoena power illuminate the problems?
Well, basically, and this was brought out in today's hearing in the Senate, when the president declared an emergency before the hurricane landfall, we should have kicked in to our national response plan, which was created in December of 2004. It would have been the first test of that plan. And by all evidence, we really didn't do that. So we didn't pre-position properly. We didn't line up our coordination with the military properly, and all of the other coordinative things. And then that follows through the first 72 hours of the disaster. And I think if we would have that line of documentation to see who was talking to whom and what they were saying, we'd understand how this fell apart.
What about the White House? What might be found from there if witnesses were subpoenaed?
Well, that would be the key thing. You know, who in DHS and FEMA was talking to who in the White House and what happened. I mean, in Chertoff's testimony today, he didn't know from the morning that the levees had problems. He didn't know till he got up the next morning that there was a problem. And the White House staff, the Homeland Security group in the White House, I think had a gap of 13 hours, they're saying. So, you know, what was the communication in between is the question.
Michael Brown, the, I guess disgraced is the right term, former head of FEMA, has said that he went around the Department of Homeland Security very specifically to get to the White House. He thought there was too much bureaucracy. Apparently, Secretary Chertoff deplored that today. What more do we know about who Mr. Brown talked to at the White House, and is that one of the things that you're trying to get more about, or do you think they ought to try to get more about?
Yeah, there is a trail of some documentation in that minority report that came out today with the bigger report by the House bipartisan select committee, in which there were only three Democrats participating, they did have an addendum of like 121 pages of documentation that shows you some of that communication that occurred, which it just all tends to lead to, and there had been testimony earlier, that the National Response Plan either was not understood at the highest levels or simply they didn't know how to follow it.
Again, Professor Bev Sigler is at Penn State University in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Come back to her in a moment. First, here's Frank Silufo, who is director of the Homeland Security Policy Institute at George Washington University. Mr. Silufo, welcome to you.
Thank you. Always good to join.
It has been said by Professor Sigler, earlier by Congressman Thompson, that one of the problems with the House report is that they didn't recommend anything. Do you think that there are important changes that need to be made?
Unequivocally, there are changes that need to be made. And I think to some extent we're framing the debate wrong. Perhaps we shouldn't be asking how FEMA should be retooled, but rather look on the back end, what are the capacities and the capabilities we need to get the job done? And there are multiple reports going on, as you highlighted. There's the Homeland Security Council report inside the White House. DHS has done their own efforts and have rolled out some of their solutions. There are two congressional reports. In addition to the House report, the Senate is moving out on theirs, and the GAO report. And I think all are good to provide perspective, but I agree with Bev in that we need to go beyond description, the nouns, to prescription, the verbs. And I do think that some of that is in fact occurring. And I think that one of the discussions that is brought up at great length is whether or not FEMA should be pulled out of the Department of Homeland Security. I personally think that would be a major mistake, because to some extent response is response is response is response. And that would further obfuscate an already complex systems-to-systems approach, and it would ask those at the state and local level, those at the pointy end of the spear, those that are ultimately going to turn victims into patients and save lives, to plug into one system when you have bad weather and plug into another system when you have bad people. I think we need to look at it from an all-hazards approach and leverage some of the capacities we have and focus on a couple of the key takeaways, prescriptions. One, situational awareness. We shouldn't be making decisions from Washington when we don't have those closest to the battlefield, to the scene of the events unfolding, providing good data to make decisions. I think that is one of the very key takeaways. The other is logistics. Logistics, 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 logistics. There's no surprise that FedEx was able to run circles to some extent around the feds because they have such sophisticated supply chain infrastructures. Walmart, same thing. UPS, those that have sophisticated Department of Defense, sophisticated logistics capacities are able to mobilize in a mass way. And then of course, there's the traditional transportation needs and requirements, which DHS doesn't own, but DOD does.
You made a reference earlier, I think, to one of the disputes that has gone on in the aftermath of Katrina, raised, as I recall, by Michael Brown, and that who said he thought that in the Department of Homeland Security, there was so much emphasis and so much concern on terrorism. You mentioned bad people. I assume that's what you're talking about.
Yes, yes.
That natural disasters were getting short shrift. You're suggesting that it's better to provide for both kinds of contingencies at once, that you can do both things at the same time?
Well, I think that there are some cultural changes that need to occur. Clearly, on the heels of 9/11, much of the focus and embedded into the DNA of the Department of Homeland Security was the focus on terrorism. Mm. So I do think there are some cultural needs, but if you were to actually look at it on the back end, what are the capabilities that need to be brought to bear? We can't fund one as effectively as we'd like to have two competing systems and to further confuse what's already a very confusing systems approach that needs to be fixed at the federal level, at the state level, and at the local level. I don't think it would help to add yet another layer and another system to be able to plug into and a whole new decision-making chain. I'm suggesting that we should look at it, what are the capabilities that are needed and what are the assets and the resources that need to be brought to bear, irrespective of whether we're responding to a natural disaster, or terrorism. With terrorism, obviously, you have a major prevention role that you can play. The first objective should be to get there before the bomb goes off to prevent terrorist incidents. It's very difficult to prevent bad weather, of course, and natural disasters. But I do think we need to look at it from the capability perspective and what's reasonable. And we need a debate on expectations. The truth is we will never be in a position to protect everything, everywhere, all the time, from every perpetrator and every modality of attack or natural disaster. And we need to start looking at what are the real expectations of what the federal government can provide, what state government can provide, what local government can provide, but also what the private sector, NGOs, and to a large extent the American people. And one of the big takeaways clearly were communities of special needs. But we need to get the American people to start asking how afraid they should be, but rather what is it they can realistically do to better protect themselves from terrorists or to better be able to respond to natural disasters.
Sounds like much like what Secretary Chertoff has said in the past, you can't protect everybody from everything all the time. Again, Frank Sulufo at George Washington University. Bev Sigler, back to you at Penn State. Do you agree that it would be a mistake to remove FEMA from the Department of Homeland Security at this point?
No, I actually have a different take on this. I think it's, at this stage, premature to decide whether FEMA should be in or out of DHS, and that's because I think the bigger problem hasn't been looked at, and that bigger problem is what I've called a clash of culture within DHS, and that clash of culture is pretty much not the words that are being used, but look at the actions in terms of funding, training exercises, disaster scenarios that have had simulations on. All of this since 9/11 has been slanted toward terrorism, despite what the Secretary of DHS is saying now.
So it is part of the DNA of the department, as Mr. Sulufo said a moment ago. Go ahead.
Yeah, so what happens is people have been looking at who it was in charge of FEMA and what their experience was. Were they disaster managers? But nobody's really taken a hard look at DHS itself. And DHS at the top is pretty much staffed by people from justice and the intelligence gathering agencies. And I think that unless, if FEMA is to stay in DHS, then we have to have a hard look at risk perception and understand that disasters are daily events. Emergency managers have to deal with disasters every day and emergencies, and only every so often is there a catastrophic event, whether it's natural or terrorist-related. And so far, the evidence is that the people at the top of DHS and at the White House, and quite frankly, Congress for the last few years since 9/11, have just misperceived risk and not understood it. And what they've done since October with DHS, the first reorganization since Katrina, was to separate preparedness from response and recovery, which doesn't really make a lot of sense. How do you respond to a disaster unless you were also preparing for it with the same people? But FEMA's been separated from that function. And I also disagree that mitigation is something you can do with terrorists. Well, yes, you can. You want to root out the terrorists, root out their funding, kill them, the whole bit. But you can mitigate natural disasters. In a way, natural is a misnomer. We have located on the coasts and made ourselves more vulnerable for more destruction of lives and property, hurricanes. And the way it is now with DHS, pretty much the state and local governments are on their own with mitigation in the natural hazards area, and money's been cut back, and I don't think we can cultivate their capabilities unless we take a hard look at mitigation once again.
Just heard a moment ago from Mark Smith in Louisiana saying that what they need is to get the levees back in business, and they're hoping that the Army Corps of Engineers will be able to do that. We also heard Frank Sulufo from Bobby Block at the Wall Street Journal that state and local emergency people are telling reporters that based on what has happened since Katrina, they are petrified with the next hurricane season hard upon us. Do you think that's appropriate? Should they be petrified at this point? Are we unprepared?
Well, I certainly think there's a lot we need to do to be better prepared. I'm not sure we can ever be 100% prepared, and I very much agree with Bev that there's a lot that needs to be done in mitigation. I was talking about preventing incidents. I also want to correct, though, one statement, and that was actually pulling FEMA out of response and recovery was well before Katrina. That was out of the secondary stage review, 2SR, which the second year anniversary, and we do need to put in perspective, the department itself is hitting its third year at March 1st. So it, to some extent, is a startup with a Fortune 1 mission. And I do think that culturally, there are some serious issues that can be addressed and quite honestly still has the opportunity to be addressed. I do think there's an awful lot more that needs to be done. And with respect to mitigation, I think we need to be looking, instead of elimination of risk, we need to be looking to how do we minimize, mitigate, and become more resilient as a community. For example, one of the efforts I'm working on here with a former architect who was a Democratic member of Congress and President Clinton's former ambassador to Denmark is how do we actually build communities from the design phase, from an architectural standpoint, to be more resilient, to factor in shelter in place, to factor in evacuation planning, to factor in strategic national stockpile distribution sites, to factor in, as we have from an environmental quality perspective, into the very design of manufacturing. And I don't hear a whole lot of discussion about that in the Gulf right now. Those are the questions I think we should be asking ourselves rather than exactly what the building should look like. I think we have an opportunity from the get-go. You don't get that opportunity every day to design a community that factors in resilience and mitigation. There's a lot of talk of interoperability of communications.
Let me ask you both one final question. We're running short of time. Frank Salufo, first to you, Director of the Homeland Security Policy Institute at George Washington University. It's been reported that the job of directing FEMA has been offered to a number of people, and they've all turned it down. Would you take it?
Would I take it? No. I don't think I'd be the best qualified.
Do you think anybody else is going to do it? That's kind of an unfair question, I realize. But do you think anybody else is going to do it very soon?
I do think you will find some quality people. I think after Katrina, with Admiral Thad Allen, and who's now been promoted to Commandant of the Coast Guard, you do have some capacities there. I don't know who that right person is.
Okay, Bev Sigler, back to you, professor at Penn State University. Again, I don't know if you want the job, but do you think that there is anybody on the horizon who would be qualified, who's liable to take it?
Okay, first, back to my earlier point, I believe that October 1 was when the preparedness directory went into effect and the second stage review. It was announced earlier, but I think it's ironic that in the midst of all these studies, the DHS made such a big decision to separate response and recovery from preparedness in terms of FEMA. And to your question, I'm totally unqualified, and the reason is the emergency management field is just highly professionalized. The people that are meeting at the National Emergency Management Association this week are best and the brightest in the country with long institutional memories, and it should be remembered that these people, many of them used to be at FEMA, and because of what's happened since 9/11 and the bad merger into DHS in terms of its flaws have pulled out, and my understanding is that at least four people have turned down that position. And it highlights one point, which is I don't think we're listening enough to those emergency management professionals as we're all talking about how to change things.
Well, thank you both. Come back, talk to us again as this story develops. Bev Sigler, professor at Penn State, Frank Salufo at the Homeland Security Policy Institute at George Washington, and thanks, of course, to the other guests on our programs as well. Vice President Dick Cheney says, "I'm the guy who pulled the trigger and shot my friend." He has finally spoken publicly about his accidental shooting of his hunting companion this weekend. Former Republican Congressman Vin Weber, who's very close to the Bush White House, has been saying that Cheney's lack of public response so far has made the issue much bigger than it needed to be. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Vice President Cheney has recorded an interview with Fox News. It's going to be broadcast in full at 6 o'clock tonight, East Coast time. In the meantime, Fox is airing excerpts. They become public domain when that happens, and here's a portion of one.
Ultimately, I'm the guy who pulled the trigger that fired the round that hit Harry. And you can talk about all of the other conditions that existed at the time, but that's the bottom line. And there's no, it's not Harry's fault. You can't blame anybody else. I'm the guy who pulled the trigger and shot my friend. And as I say, that's something I'll never forget.
Vice President Cheney, once again speaking to Fox News today, taking responsibility for what happened this weekend. David Sanger is White House correspondent for The New York Times. David, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Warren.
We obviously don't know all of what is in that interview, but that was a fairly explicit acceptance of responsibility, however, somewhat late.
Yeah, well, I tell you, Warren, I've covered a lot of things in Washington over a lot of years, and this has been one of the wackier weeks I have seen. It's, you know, was strangest, I guess, for the 24-hour silence about what had even happened, and then the White House's effort to try to argue that disclosure was constituted by having the owner of the ranch call the local paper in Corpus Christi and explain that an accident had happened some 18 or 20 hours after it happened. It's been bizarre, and one of the most bizarre parts about it is that you have seen the split between the president's aides and the vice president's.
Elaborate a bit on that.
Well, Vice President Cheney has always operated in sort of his own cocoon, as one White House official once put it to me. He's got his own separate staff, as most vice presidents do. He has a fairly large national security staff. They come up with their own policy positions. They argue them and work for them within the government. But frequently it is not highly coordinated with what's happening across the street with the president's staff. And the result on Saturday night, as the news of this first hit the White House, was that there didn't appear to be anybody who was either able or willing to step in and say to the vice president, you know, you have to go explain this yourself and you have to turn out a statement. So we had radio silence, and then the first statement that came out, which I think was Monday afternoon, was not a statement of regret or apology or anything like that, but instead a statement from the vice president's office saying that he had sent in a check for the $7 hunting stamp he was missing. That seemed a little out of link with perhaps what needed to be said at that moment.
I should say, before we go any further, that for our listeners, Harry Whittington is said to be in stable condition today. He did, of course, have a mild heart attack yesterday, atrial fibrillation, because of the shotgun pellet that traveled close to his heart. They are saying once again today that they're optimistic and that they think even he might be able to return to work today. Interesting report also made that when they were asked as to whether his blood alcohol level was tested, apparently the people at the White House had no – excuse me, the people at the hospital, I beg your pardon, had no comment about that. David Sanger, once again, here's Vin Weber saying that their response has made this a lot worse than it might have been. What about it when people start asking that kind of question and they get no comments? Where is that going to lead people?
You know, it's my personal view, and people will say I have a strong interest in the answer to this being toward full disclosure. My personal view that whenever something like this happens, you want to get as much detail out as you possibly can, as quickly as you can, because otherwise you raise the specter that there is some kind of cover-up underway. And so it's one of the reasons that this needed to get sorted out quickly. And I think you've heard from Vin Weber, you've heard from Marlon Fitzwater, you've heard from Ari Fleischer and others who say that they don't think this was handled terribly well. And then you heard the press secretary to the president, Scott McClellan, for the past 2 days, offer some very pointed comparisons between how this was handled and an incident you may or may not recall that happened back when the president last year got into a bicycling accident in Scotland. I don't know if you remember this one, but He came around a corner. There was a policeman standing guard there, a Scottish policeman. He collided with him, and the policeman had to be taken to the hospital. Fortunately, you know, nobody was badly hurt. The president wasn't hurt at all. But at the time, the White House immediately had a telephone conference call with reporters, explained what happened, kept them updated on the condition of the policemen, described the details of how this occurred. It was the exact opposite of the way this was handled, and I think that that was Mr. McClellan's point by describing this to us, which was to say there's a procedure for this and it wasn't followed.
That's probably one of the reasons that most of us don't remember that incident. Again, we're talking with David Sanger, the White House correspondent for the New York Times. If there is, in fact, this division between the staffs of the president and the vice president, and Mr. Cheney is widely regarded as the most powerful vice president in history, what does that say about the making of policy and the running of the government in this administration?
Well, it may not say that much right now. I mean, I think you could argue that that Vice President Cheney played a very critical role for the president when he had, when the president first came to office and had little foreign policy experience, and you know, needed somebody to help guide him, or needed many people to do that. Now the president, I think, feels more comfortable with the subject matter. You know, has been through the searing events of 9/11, two wars, and so forth. And so I think it's conceivable that, that Vice President Cheney's role was naturally going to evolve anyway. And because the vice president has no political ambitions, he tells us, he may not have felt compelled to get out and explain himself as much. And that may put him at somewhat at odds with a White House that's concerned about the overall image of their own leadership and Republican leadership as the midterm elections approach.
All right. So there is a great deal at stake here. We have not yet heard all of the interview that the vice president has done with the Fox News. We don't know what kind of questions were asked, much less the answers that were given. We will all await, of course, that interview. And once again, it is on Fox News, which I suppose David Sanger will make everybody in the White House press corps, except the White House, the Fox News correspondent, angry. But that's perhaps for another
time. You pick your venues with some care, and I think we could all give various explanations about why they picked
this. All right. Okay. David Sanger, as always, good to talk with you.
Good to talk to you.
White House correspondent of New York Times. Today's program produced by Andrea Brody with Jonah King, Christian Bordahl, and Karen Radziner, Technical Director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.